The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Steve Schooner. Steve is a Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. Steve, welcome to the show.
Great to be back, Roger. Thanks for having me on.
Well, as always, I'm looking forward to this conversation because, quite frankly, I don't know what you're going to say. Well, that's the way it's supposed to work, right?
Neither do I, but based on our conversation earlier, we have plenty of good things to talk about because there's always something going on in federal acquisition.
Right, and I know one of the things that really sort of struck you and it's our first topic of the day is Frank Kendall's memo with regard to low price technically acceptable was
great
issued.
Great stuff.
Right. March 4th of this year. So have at it. Go ahead.
Okay. So, again, March 4th, 2015. And again, for those of you who are listening to the show, this is your assignment for today. Everybody write this one down. March 4th, 2015. Frank Kendall, that's the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics, put out a wonderful short memo. And the memo is about the appropriate use of LPTA source selection and other contract types. Now, again, let's just be clear on a couple things. LPTA, lowest price technically acceptable. But what you're looking for is that March 4, 2015 memo, and it's pretty easy to find on the internet. Let me say two things about it before we get to the substance. The first is for acquisition professionals, particularly if you're in the private sector, but also government employees, I am encouraging all of you to print a copy of this memo, stuff it in your pocket, and carry it everywhere. Or, if you're more technologically savvy, download a PDF of it, carry it around in your cloud file, put it in the desktop of your memo. But in any event, keep this memo handy. It is an incredibly valuable piece of information. Let me also mention that the day the memo came out, I happened to be teaching that evening, and I brought it to class, and I used it as an example of effective, efficient, persuasive writing. The memo is very, very short. It is to the point. It is wonderfully clear, easy to read, and easy to understand. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that's in contrast to many documents that come out of government offices, but the main thing is, first of all, the memo is important. Second, it is beautifully written. It's clear. And again, let's get now to the substance. All right. So the memo is not that long, but the first paragraph basically makes the simple point that many of us already knew, but it's wonderful to have it coming out as DOD policy guidance, and that is you don't use LPTA or lowest price technically acceptable procurements. You don't use that approach as a default. You use it only when it's appropriate. And when is it appropriate? Among other times. You only use LPTA when your requirements have already been defined, or in other words, you know exactly what you want to buy. You also only use LPTA when the risk of unsuccessful contract performance is minimal, or in other words, where you're confident that everybody who's going to provide a proposal knows what they're going to do and there's no big unknowns. Third, you only use LPTA, lowest price technically acceptable, when price is a significant factor. And the flip side to that, and this is, again, the beauty of the memo says, you only use LPTA, lowest price technically acceptable, when there is no value, no need, or no willingness to pay for higher performance. Or in other words, if you're willing to pay more for a better outcome, don't use LPTA. Thank you, Frank Kendall. I just can't say enough about how wonderful this basic premise is. Okay, and that's just the first paragraph.
Man, I have to calm you down here, Steve. So go ahead. Second paragraph or further on?
Well, let's keep going. So the second paragraph, and again, one of the problems is you have to keep this in context, and this is now where some data helps. It was not so many years ago where at the highest policy levels, the Defense Department sent the message to the acquisition community that LPTA was the answer to all of the questions. They have now looked at the data, and what did they find? When acquisition professionals hear from their bosses, they're supposed to use LPTA for everything. What do?
They use LPTA for everything. Did I get that one right, Professor?
That was brilliant, Roger. Very well done. But we now have the data, and what they've seen is there was, in fact, an overreaction to the policy guidance. People told them to use LPTA. They started using it. It went too far. Now they need to ratchet back. So the beauty of the second paragraph is it makes the important point that when you use a lowest price technically acceptable approach in your solicitation, when you shouldn't have, or in other words, improper use, can cause the Defense Department or, in effect, any government agency to miss the opportunity to secure an innovative or a cost-effective solution. In other words, if you hyper-define the requirement and say you're looking for the lowest price, you may not get the innovative solution that may be more helpful. And more importantly, you may not get the cost-effective solution. Or in other words, let's remember, low price is a false economy. In other words, sometimes it's worth paying more money for a better solution. So all of those things jammed into that very simple statement in the second paragraph.
Right. Well, another aspect too is like low price may not lead to actual successful performance.
Exactly. Right? In other words, the message that you send when you put LPTA out there is you're not looking for the best solution. You're looking for the cheapest solution that meets the standard that you've articulated. If somebody out there who you didn't pick up in your market research, if there's a firm out there who's thought about something new and exciting or can solve your problem, it might be worth paying a price premium for that. But you're never going to know if you don't ask the right question. And LPTA asks the wrong question.
Right. And, you know, in these days, too, with all the talk about we need innovative companies to do business with the federal government, LPTA sends the wrong message.
It's also entirely consistent with the big message that we are seeing in Better Buying Power 3, which is it's all about maintaining technical superiority, right?
Right.
So we'll come back to that as well. Okay. By the time we get to the third paragraph, the memo explains that frequently having a trade-off between cost or price and non-cost factors is typically the optimal solution. But we knew that, okay? But now we've got it in writing, and this is one of the reasons I'm encouraging people to read the memo and carry it around with you. If you're in a situation and somebody says, no, we want the low-price solution, it's great to have some ammunition to say, you know, the low-price solution may not give us the opportunity to find the effective or the efficient or the cost-effective solution to our needs, even if we have to pay the price premium. All right, so now, then the memo kind of changes gears all of a sudden, because remember from the title, it's a multiple-use memo. By the time you get to the fourth paragraph, they talk about the fact that selection of the solicitation type and the contract type is important. But it's not just that you should always keep in mind that there's not just one answer to every question, but particularly with regard to services. Low price is probably not the best way to buy services. And again, we can go through our favorite list of examples, but as you're driving in your car, particularly if you're thinking about the drivers around you out there, how many of you are thinking about choosing your heart surgeon based on lowest price? How many of you can imagine going out into the marketplace and hiring a nanny or someone to take care of your kids based upon the lowest price? It just doesn't make any sense. So I think that's great information. And then the last one I'd mentioned, by the time we get to paragraphs 5 and 6 of the memo, there they literally just step right up to the plate. And what Kendall says is only use fixed price contracts when they're appropriate. Hallelujah. We knew that was important, but you should not use fixed price contracts if you can't predict the tasks, if you can't predict the outcomes, and you can't predict the amount of effort required. I mean, look, that's common sense, but it's wonderful to have it in writing.
That is great to have in writing. And so how you mentioned Better Buying 3.0, and is this to me is almost like 3.0.5 or something? 3.5?
But it's interesting. It's interesting that this was rolled out separately.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think that it has to be taken in context. Let me just mention one other thing that we want to keep in mind from the memo, and that's buried deep in the memo is the fact that it's perfectly okay to use time and materials contracts when it's appropriate. Thank you again, Frank Kendall. Now, again, here's where the data is so important, Roger. You know, look, what we saw was it was very, very clear from the highest levels of the government, a number of years ago, time and materials contracts was bad.
Yeah, bad. Very bad.
Okay. And then what happened in the data? If you look at the CSCS data from last year, we basically wiped out the use of time and materials contracts across the government. But that's nuts. I realize you shouldn't use time and materials contract when you're buying something new, right?
Right.
If I'm going to hire a plumber for new construction, they can give me a fixed price for what it'll cost to install toilets and water fountains. But if you want someone to come in and work on a project and you don't know what's wrong, you may be overpaying if you demand a fixed price solution when the real thing may be, let's just find out what's wrong and tell me how many hours it's going to take to fix it.
Well, I guarantee you'd be overpaying. It's, you know, that's the risk. That's the allocation of risk, right? And, you know, and that's the situation with unknowns. The price is going to be higher to account for that risk. I mean, that's business. That makes absolute common sense.
So I think that the important thing to remember is, and I remember Matthew Blum did a beautiful job discussing this when we were doing the studies on time and materials contracts a few years ago. It is irrational to say that time and materials contracting is inappropriate. It is inappropriate where you know exactly what the nature of the task,
yes,
what the nature of the effort, and the nature of the outcome is. But it is fully appropriate, and it is typically the most efficient solution to use time and materials contracts where you don't know what the nature of the task is, and it's the best way to go about doing it. And it's great to see that in writing.
Right. And Steve, right now we have to take our first break. My guest today is Steve Schooner. He is a Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And you are. And when we come back, we'll talk better buying power 3.0, maybe a little bit more about time, material, labor hour. We'll see. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. He is Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And I think we have covered LPTA for today, right?
As long as you remember, the March 4 memo. Right. Get the March 4 memo. Carry it around. Use it frequently.
Yeah, you have your homework assignments, every folks out there. So do get a hold of that memo. Put it in your pocket and carry it around. I do. All right. And I was tested today. And
I saw it. Roger's got a hard copy of the memo.
That's right. So Steve, this segment, I think we wanted to talk about a little bit about better buying power 3.0. You know, that's actually issued just about a month before the, or a month after, frankly, the memo on LPTA, you know, sort of.
And they're making progress on this. So, I think we got to give DOD some credit for making progress on better buying power. I frankly admit I was one of the real skeptics on the original better buying power. I thought it was openly hostile to the private sector. I thought it had a condescending message. And I thought that the underlying message was all about squeezing the contractors because there wasn't much money to go around. And look, I understand that. But by the time Frank Kendall took it over and rolled out better buying power 2.0, the message had already been refined and improved. And for those of you that haven't followed this, the theme on better buying power 2.0 was it was a guide to help you think.
Think, yes.
And look, anytime we've got senior policy officials reminding the acquisition workforce that following the rules is good, but thinking about the outcome, thinking about serving the customer, thinking about getting value for money, I'm already thinking we're making some progress. Now, the problem when we got to Better Buying Power 3.0, the original rollout, and keep in mind that the original rollout 3.0 was rolled out as a draft. The draft got rolled out, and frankly, I think the message got lost in the weeds. For those of you that look at the Better Buying Power summary slides, for example, on the web or in hard copy, what you saw is from Better Buying Power 2.0 to 3.0, the font got smaller and there were even more words on the page. Okay.
Yes.
So it does look like there's a trying to please everybody kind of approach to this, or maybe a kitchen sink. And I feel for the people who are trying to manage this activity. Every defense acquisition form has to be jammed in there. Okay. Now, thematically, we lost the word think in big, bold letters, which is, I think, kind of a shame because that was a good message. And we started seeing the themes of cost consciousness, professionalism, and technical excellence. And that's okay. But the other stuff that kind of got stuffed in there, we've got small business policies in there that are kind of distracting and the like. The interesting thing, though, is if you walk away from the big, or what I would call the busy slide, And if you even walk away from the original memo with regard to its release, what you see is that there is a fact sheet you can find on the web. And the fact sheet, I think, is where the real message is. What DoD says is that Better Buying Power 3.0 focuses attention on the overriding concern that the nation's technological superiority is at risk. Wow. Okay, that is an important message. So we can talk about all of these little rules that talk about how we're going to buy this or save a penny here or do something like that. But why are we buying things? The only reason we buy stuff is so the government can govern and DoD can protect the public. Okay. DoD says in the Better Buying Power 3.0 fact sheet that the nation's technological superiority depends upon the effectiveness of the government's research and development efforts. They also go on to say that innovation increasingly comes from the commercial sector and from overseas. So in other words, DoD's ability to identify and utilize sources of innovation and technology effectively rests on the professionalism of the workforce. Now, here again, the data is telling. Let's go back to, you know, empirical evidence here. If you look at the CSIS study that came out last year, and in fact, this is the last big data crunching effort that Dave Berteau did before he left CSIS and went back to the Defense Department.
For the listening audience, just tell them to see it.
CSIS, the Center for Strategic and Industrial Studies. So if you go to the CSIS webpage, and you can just Google Dave Berteau and you'll find it fast enough, Berteau. The last big study they did where they look at all the numbers of where the spending was showed, frankly, I think a shocking but not surprising outcome. And that is, if you go back to when the sequestration issues first started arising, when the budget started tightening up, the single line item where DoD had the greatest reduction in spending was research and development. Now, look, it's not surprising. When you're cutting budgets, when you're not fighting as much anymore, the first thing to go is the kind of forward-looking and innovative thinking. But what we found is, if DoD is not spending money on research and development, and the contractors are not spending money on independent research and development because they're seeing their overhead being squeezed, all of a sudden, there's no innovation that's going on. It's not like the threats are being reduced around the world. So there's lots of threats, and there's different threats. The most dramatic example being cybersecurity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Somebody's got to spend money on research and development. And what we're seeing is we're not spending money on those things. And how are we going to maintain technical superiority if what we're focused on is things like lowest price technically acceptable, should cost analysis, and you know anything else off the original list from Better Buying Power? So I think it's a legitimate concern.
Your thoughts on this, that you know, you talk about should cost and focusing on that, but they do talk about strengthening, expanding should cost based on cost management. What does that mean?
So I have to say, I am still underwhelmed by the policy guidance that we've gotten on should cost analysis. I think that in many ways, should cost is all about DoD being actively involved in managing their contractors to minimize waste. But to this day, I think the most telling thing that we've heard Frank Kendall say on these issues is the reality that when you squeeze the contractor's overhead, it changes the nature of the Defense Department's relationship with its contractors. I think the example that Frank used, and I'm not going to say this quite as articulately as he did, but what he described is a scenario where most program managers are used to the experience where they have a relationship with their big contractor, and someone comes to them with a new application or a new technology they want integrated into their weapon system. And so the program manager calls up the contractor and says, hey, somebody showed me this new technology. Can we work that into our program? And the contractor says, wow, that's awesome. Let me get back to you on that. And they call a bunch of their scientists and engineers and systems integrators, and they get to work, and they call the program manager back 2 weeks later, say, look, this is how it works. Well, if you tell the contractor that we can't afford excess overhead and you can't afford to have idle capacity anymore, now you call the contractor and the program manager says, hey, I got this new technology. Can I integrate it into my system? And the contractor says, we would love to discuss an advisory and assistance contract with you so that we could look into your interesting research question.
Right. Sure. Absolutely. And that's, to me, that's you know, you're focusing on an issue too, and that I hear from companies all the time is just the increasing amount of indirect costs or overhead costs that are associated with the process as opposed to the actual performance of work and or, you know, investments in research and development. All this process driven, whether it's data reporting or whatever, or other compliance requirements that's eating into, you know, money that would go directly to performance or, you know, or returns on research.
Let's use the term cost drivers, because I think it's really a good term. When Ash Carter rolled out Better Buying Power, he basically stood up in a room of industry people and said he wanted to eliminate the cost drivers, at which point all the industry people in the room stood up and said, you're the one that generates the cost drivers. The cost drivers come from statute, they come from regulation, they come from policy, they come from mandates. And so if you want us to reduce our overhead, you know, look, we can eliminate our compliance systems. We can stop producing cost or pricing data. We can stop doing reports that you mandate that we do. But the bottom line is these are not things the contractor, the private sector community generates. So DOD is, in fact, the source of these issues. And what happens is when we squeeze the overhead, most of the inefficient cost drivers don't go away. But that kind of capacity that DOD has come to rely on, the ability to just call the contractors and say, hey, I need intellectual capacity.
Right.
Give me some
pursue
thinking
this
right
idea.
Now.
I got this. Right. Yeah, right, right.
They're going to have to pay for that now. And there's no money to pay for it because we just talked about the fact that the single biggest hit is in R&D. So right. If we're not doing the R&D and you can't ask the contractor to do it for free, where's it going to come from?
Right. And you know, we do have to take our next break, Steve. When we come back, I want to follow up on 3.0 and how do you incentivize research and development and the whole issue around allocation of intellectual property.
Money's
right?
Good incentive. Yeah,
well, the money is too, but also, but I'm also talking about money when you talk about allocation of intellectual property rights and you know further use of something you've developed either jointly or privately. For a project.
Interesting battleground, yeah.
Yes. My guest today is Steve Schooner. He is a Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington Law School. And when we come back, we'll be asking him some more about 3.0. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. He is a Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington Law School. And Steve, when we took the break, we were talking 3.0, Better Buying Power 3.0, and a step forward in, you know, I guess, thinking about how to conduct procurement and how to incentivize technological superiority to a certain extent. That seems to be the focus.
Yeah, how to maintain technical superiority with less money, right? That's a big challenge.
That is a huge challenge.
That's pulling a rabbit out of a hat.
Right. Well, yeah, it would be. So, yeah, one way to incentivize things is to throw some money at it, right? But one thing I wanted to ask you about, and it does boil down to money in a certain sense, what can you do with your intellectual property that you develop and you do it in concert with the government for a project? And the allocation of those intellectual property rights. To me, it seems there's an opportunity there to incentivize innovation, perhaps with regard to what people can do with you know something they develop. But at the same time, you know, in the past, it's always about we have this so we can give it to others so they can do exactly what you just did for us.
You have really identified what I think is one of the most challenging issues out in the marketplace today. So. If you go back to what we were talking about with the early Better Buying Power, DOD basically said the message that they wanted to control that contractor IR&D, the independent research and development. And the theory is, if we're spending the money, if we, DOD, is spending the money, and you're doing research and development, even if you're doing it independently, it's our money, we should own the intellectual property, and we should own the opportunities and the applications that flow from it. I think what you are describing, Roger, is a really important thing, which is the real way that you innovate research and development is by empowering people to come up with ideas that they're going to be able to exploit for commercial gain later. Now, it is possible that the Defense Department may be the beneficiary of that, but they wouldn't benefit as much as if someone came up with a good idea and then they could give it to everyone and not pay for that more than once. But the reality is, in the private sector, and there's, look, I'm not telling anybody anything they don't know. There's a fair amount of research on where innovation comes from. In the private sector, companies spend staggering amounts of money on research and development so that they can come up with an idea someone else doesn't have, so that they can generate short-term monopoly positions, so that they can charge disproportionately high prices for things that nobody else has until everybody else catches up. And they take the profits from their extremely high prices, plow them back into innovation so they can come up with the next new project that they can charge an above market price for. Or in other words, why did you pay a price premium for the newest iPhone rather than waiting for the last iPhone, which you could have gotten as a bargain 6 months later? Because most people want something that's new and cool, and that's where the profits are. All right. If we are talking about achieving technical superiority, the question is, how do we incentivize the market to basically get that for you? You're either going to have to pay for it, or you're going to have to convince the private sector that it's in their interest to do the kind of research that you want. And frankly, that's a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not, we're not going to solve this issue today here.
But. Let me mention one related one, since we're talking about technical type stuff. One of the things that I liked in Better Buying Power 3.0 is they mentioned the increased use of draft technical specifications.
Draft RFPs, request for information,
but
that sort of thing.
This is great. So they're specifically talking about draft technical specifications. And as you indicated, it piggybacks on the principle that we've now been living with for more than a decade, that the increased use of draft RFPs makes sense. Now, look, we could joke about the fact that if you've never written a proposal, it's a little bit disingenuous to think that you're going to be able to write a great request for proposals because you don't know what questions to ask. But what we've all learned from experience, and we've seen this time and time again, that if the government puts the draft RFP out on the street, they're going to get feedback that will dramatically improve that product before they finally release it. What DOD has taken from that message, and this is intuitive and it's correct, it's logical, and I respect them for doing it, is, wow, why don't we do the same thing with our technical specifications? Look, we have been joking our entire lives about insane technical specifications that ask for things that we don't need or focus on design rather than performance. But just like everything else, just like we learned that the draft RFP makes sense, I think that the more tech specs the DOD rolls out in draft forms, the much, much better results they're going to get when they finally do get to actually going out on the street for a competition.
You know, it's some sort of like things, you know, what goes around comes around, or, you know, or you work long enough in this business or any business and you see the same thing over again, right?
Cycles, there's, waves, right.
There's no
pendulums.
New idea. But I remember when I first started in government, at GSA, which managed a lot of specs actually, from ambulances to, you know, because GSA bought a lot of vehicles, is that those would be put out for people to take a look at periodically and provide feedback on them.
The question that you have to ask yourself is, why do we forget the successful lessons learned? Now, one perfectly logical answer is the acquisition workforce has been in a state of crisis literally at this point for decades. There's not enough people. They're being asked to do ridiculous things. And frankly, risk-averse behavior is what's incentivized. Nobody is rewarding contracting professionals for being innovative and creative. The only thing that they've heard is don't screw up, because if you screw up, we're going to make an example out of you. We're going to hang you out to dry and you're going to be in the newspapers. So what happens is people get conservative and that doesn't get you good results.
Right. Well, that's, you know, you're sort of touching on the role of the oversight community as well as part of the sort of the ongoing second guessing of or Monday morning quarterbacking.
Absolutely. Right? And the other complicating thing, and here's another really good theme from Better Buying Power 3.0. We started to hear this from Carter originally, and you're hearing it more from Frank Kendall, but the focus on the increased tradecraft in services. And I like the fact that in Better Buying Power 3.0, they focus specifically on two aspects of services where the government needs a fair amount of help. One is requirements definition, and the other is post-award contract management. Let's focus on them separately, just real quick. In terms of requirements definition, if the customer and the buyer are unable to effectively communicate, then the odds that the government is going to write and release a request for proposals that's going to get a solution that is consistent with what the customer wanted in the first place are very, very low. how do we train these people to communicate?
Right.
It's hard.
Yeah. And we'll pick up on that question when we come back from the break. My guest today is Steve Schooner. He is Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Steve Schooner. He is the Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School. And Steve, when we took the break, you were about to go on a riff on
services.
Services and tradecraft and 3.0 a little bit. So I'm going to let you go at that.
Okay. So we had talked about the fact that the focus on increased tradecraft and services and better buying power 3.0 primarily had two focuses. One was on the requirements definition, and we need to be able to train the acquisition community to extract good, meaningful information from the end user or the requirements community so they can communicate that to the private sector. But the other one that I think we all agree the government needs a lot of help with is training and experiential learning with regard to post-award contract management. Or in other words, if you're listening to this show, you already know that awarding a contract is not a successful endeavor. The challenge is, after the contract is awarded, ensuring that the customer gets what the contractor promised to provide. And that is a partnership. That is an ongoing relationship. And particularly with regard to services, this requires management. Yeah, I think we alluded briefly to child care and nannies earlier in the show.
Yes, we did, about when we're talking LPTA.
Right. So, you know, I can hire someone to do child care for my kids, but that's an ongoing requirement. If I'm not communicating with the people who are providing care for my kids, they don't know what's important to me. They don't know what I want them to focus on. This is an ongoing relationship. And the difficulties associated with post-award contract management and services are incredibly different than just ensuring that a contractor met a specification when you had, for example, a supply contract. You can't measure it with calipers, is the bottom line with services.
Right. Well, and this is an ongoing issue. I mean, this was an issue when, you know, in the dark ages, I was still in government.
when we were all young.
Right, yeah. Contract performance and actually ensuring, you know, good outcomes or, you know, the customer actually receiving the performance they, you know, contracted for has always been this challenge. And is it all the issue that, to your point, you know, the sexy part is awarding the contract and being able to stand up, I successfully got through without having a bid protest, but to think strategically about, you know, your agency mission, that's just the first step in that process, fundamentally.
So the point you make is a good one, but it's even more complex or pernicious than that. Let's be clear about the fact that if you went somewhere and said, hey, what does the government do annually in terms of procurement? People would say, well, let's look at USA spending. How much money in contracts was awarded? Not what did they get for the money, right?
Right.
So the idea that awarding the contract, that's something that we keep track of. Was there a competition? Who cares? What I want to know is, did I get value for my money? So we focus on the formation phase, keeping in mind that in terms of the cradle-to-grave experience of procurement, you've got to go all the way through performance and quality assurance and the like. But we had talked earlier about maybe doing a thought experiment on that. Can I digress into that for a second?
You want to host the show? Go ahead. No, I was actually going to bring up the thought experiment in contract management administration.
So. All right. So whether you're sitting at your desk or whether you're sitting in your car, I want you to just let go for a second and think. All right. And I'll tell you how this came about. But I was at a contract management conference in Uganda last year, of all places, Entebbe, Uganda. And we were basically there for a week. And it was only discussing how you manage contracts after they get awarded. And it makes a lot of sense if you think about the kind of things that the United Nations buy. They buy everything from SUVs to what you might think of as MASH units. But again, they're huge consumers of arms-bearing contractors. But what I realized in talking to the group was that people had very, very different perspectives about the point. So here's my question for you. If I just ask in a vacuum, what's the point of contract administration? Or what's the point, what's the goal of contract administration? In other words, what are you actually trying to achieve if I ask you to manage or administer my contract after it's been awarded? Well, the easy thing with the thought experiment is most people, I think, are going to answer the basic question that as a government contract administrator, an ACO, or someone managing the contract, my job is to ensure that the contractor fulfills its promise to the government. My job is to ensure that the contractor delivers for the agreed upon price, at the agreed upon time, and they meet all of the performance specifications. But might I suggest to you that equally importantly, or very, very differently, and this is where the division comes in, that the real point of contract management is to ensure that the customer gets the goods or services they need in order to perform the agency mission. And is it indeed possible that ensuring 100% compliance with the contract may fail to ensure that the customer gets the goods or services they need to actually perform the contract? Now, on one hand, this is one of the reasons that we have a changes clause in government contracts.
Absolutely.
It's one of the reasons that we have a termination for convenience clause. We understand that requirements change. But if we begin from the premise that there's the potential for miscommunication between the requirements community and the people that wrote the draft specification or the specification itself, we need to be able to ensure that the buyer is focused on customer satisfaction. We have to understand that the only reason we're spending money is so that agency officials can actually achieve their mission. And the problem is there is so much pressure today on the acquisition professional to focus on compliance and compliance only. In other words, you are never going to get in trouble if the contractor does exactly what they promised. The fact that the customer, the end user, the warfighter, the head of the agency, the fact that they're complaining they didn't get what they wanted, the press is never going to talk about that. They might, but that's not front page news. Front page news is failure to fulfill the contract requirements. Look, there's a fundamental problem there. We should only be spending the money to get the things we want and we need.
Right. And you're talking, you're really talking sophistication, nuance, objective, which is this is what the contract says versus much more subjective. And it seems to me that the very nature of particularly of services contracting or you're buying a solution is you cannot, as a no matter how well you know your requirement or if it's a complex service requirement, you cannot put on paper everything that you really need or what you expect, and it can change over time.
Exactly.
Right? And so there's that sort of gray area or unspoken area where that goes to ultimate customer satisfaction.
And it wasn't so long ago that we tried to write service contracts, right? Remember the era before we got to performance-based service contract, right? I mean, when I was in private practice, I had a contractor who had a big custodial contract. Everything that every custodian did was in that contract.
Right. You're coming like twice a day, you sweep the floor,
you
things like that.
You change the toilet paper roll, whatever.
Yeah, I remember those
you
days.
You buff the floors for so many revolutions per square meter, right?
Right, I mean, right.
So we can to some extent describe outcomes, but at the end of the day with services, we really need to be focused on what the needs are because that's what we should be paying for.
Absolutely. So we got about 2 minutes left, Steve. It's amazing how fast it goes. But I wanted to give you a chance to talk. I always like to ask you what you've read lately. Do you have any recommendations, book recommendations for the listeners?
All right. Yeah. So let me give you at least one substantively related one and two irrelevant ones since we're just talking. For those who are interested in a little bit of procurement history, just to kind of get an interesting lessons learned, there's a book out called Trump Card, Holding America's Enemies at Bay, Trump Card by a guy named James Barr. What's interesting is the book is actually a repackaging and reprinting of a book that was written many decades ago. It's about the Polaris submarine system. I encourage it for one reason and one reason only. The book makes the unequivocal case that if you empower an acquisition official with real authority to go out and operate outside the rules to achieve a serious priority for the government, we can do that. But if you want to live in a world that's all about rules and not priorities and getting the job done, that's the world we live in most of the time.
Right. That goes back to the earlier discussion of did you meet all the written contract requirements or did you satisfy the user? It's the same thing, right?
Yeah, that's a really good one. But you know, and to the extent that I can go off topic for a second, the book that I really loved last year was All the Light We Cannot See. That was Anthony Doerr's book. I think it just won the Pulitzer Prize recently. Can't recommend that one enough. It's World War II stuff and, frankly, right. Lyrical, beautiful, thoughtful.
Okay. I want to thank my guest today, Steve Schooner. He is a Nash and Sabinick Professor of Government Procurement Law at the George Washington University Law School, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.